time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Robert Donnelly. Robert Donnelly is a native Oregonian and an assistant professor of history at Gonzaga University in Spokane, and he is here to talk about his new book, Dark Rose, Organized Crime and Corruption in Portland. Robert, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing your book, Dark Rose?
Well, growing up in rural Oregon, we'd head up to the big city of Portland at the time in the, you know, in the 70s and the 80s where my grandparents lived. My mom was from Portland. And we'd hit Interstate 5 and go on up, and we'd hit Portland, and it was scary. You know, the big city was scary at first, and but then more and more as I got older and older, it became fascinating. You know, all big cities are like this, right? You know, going to New York for the first time, you're driving to Seattle for the first time, you get kind of chills. And so Portland just was fascinating and scary at the same time. Well, doing that over the years, I just started to get this draw to Portland and did my undergraduate work at Western Oregon University, and then decided to go to Portland State University for my master's degree. And living in Portland was like a dream come true. Living in a city is great. You know, growing up in rural Oregon, it's great. But living in the city was just really exciting. And I had to write a master's thesis, and I knew that this was a big project, and I had to find a topic that I was really interested in, and always sort of like the Woodward and Bernstein story of muckrakers raking it up, you know, raking up corruption. And but on the same, I think I was also bitten by maybe the Godfather bug, you know, all the mafia movies, and so I just knew that this very, very, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, this very progressive city of Portland had to have some, you know, seedy sides. So I read a few books, and there weren't not a lot written on, you know, at the time on corruption and crime and organized crime, particularly in Portland, because it's a small town, small city. And just started reading more and more and found that there is a little bit of a underbelly, you know, some really good crime and a really great crime story. Now, I didn't find that there was this big family from East Coast running the rackets in Portland, but I found that it was a very local organized crime operation. While I was working on this, and I was reading newspaper articles from the 1950s, and I read a dissertation by Joe Uris there at Portland State, who he kind of, you know, dabbled with the idea that there was organized crime in Portland, but how big was it? It wasn't very big. And there weren't really any national connections. So the motivation was just more and more interest. And I got the master's thesis finished, and I decided, well, I want to teach, of course. And I knew that I had to go get my PhD. So I applied to Marquette University in Wisconsin, a number of places, but I decided on Marquette in Milwaukee. And Milwaukee is a great city, great people, really made a lot of great friends. Marquette's a great school, but it wasn't Portland. And I wanted to get back to Portland, and I just felt like I had unfinished business with this topic. So I proposed it as a dissertation topic, and my advisor there was incredibly supportive, and the university funded my research to move back home. And so I got to, you know, interview all these people, and it just, the story just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and everybody wants to talk about it. And it turned out to be a pretty theoretical dissertation, but the story, the underlying story that's really actually the focus of the book, you know, we weeded out sort of a lot of the theoretical, and I wouldn't say we weeded out a lot of the analytical. It's an academic book on one end, but it's also got this really great meaty story about this vice scandal of 1956 in Portland. And it just turned out to be a really great topic, and I think that the more I talk to people, they say, you got to turn this into a book. And so we did. UW Press was, you know, University of Washington Press, so incredibly supportive. First-time author, it was a gamble for them, but they loved the story, and so that's why I keep telling this story of this vice scandal of 1956 that had not only local implications, of course. 1956, the Oregonian expose written by Wallace Turner and William Lambert. Wallace Turner, you know, these guys actually get awards for this expose, talking about this, they really uncovered, the muckrakers. They uncovered not only organized crime and not necessarily a big syndicate, but this local crime boss had this monopoly. But he also found that the Teamsters Union was involved. Now, Wally Turner might, ring some bells here in Seattle, because he was, after he leaves the Oregonian with incredible awards, and he ends up going to work for the New York Times, and he becomes the bureau chief here in Seattle for the New York Times eventually. He just passed away back in September. But anyway, these guys write this expose that just blows the lid off of not only, again, vice crime and organized crime in Portland, and not only labor racketeering that the Teamsters are connected to it, but of course law enforcement corruption. Lots of corruption in Portland in the 1950s, which shouldn't be that surprising, because it's going on in Seattle, it's going on in New York and in Chicago and in Philadelphia and in Detroit. So it's not, and that's also, part of the book. It's like, why aren't we studying Portland in my urban history class that I teach at Gonzaga? Because these same things are happening right here in the Pacific Northwest at the same time. So nobody's writing on this. And so that was a little bit of the motivation, too, to get the book published. It's like, it's just really a fascinating story that really is not necessarily unique to Portland, but nobody's writing about it. So
talk more about one of the primary characters in it, James Elkins.
Well, Jim Elkins was the guy there, the racketeer. He had a lock, he had a monopoly on this. Again, we're not talking about, the big families from the East Coast or, big organized crime syndicates coming out from Los Angeles that are connected to Vegas, nothing like that. It's really local organized crime, and you're going to find that in most cities throughout the 20th century. It's mostly local. So he was the local crime boss, and he had a great operation going. He controlled all the gambling, the prostitution, and the way he was able to control that was paying off the cops and mayors, for that matter, and sheriffs, and, paying them off. Well, he's a really interesting story. He's not the focus of the book, but he's a really interesting story. He could be a good bio someday, maybe, on James Elkins. But he has this lock, and he at one point wants to put his gambling machines, his slot machines, in the Oregon Labor Temple, where the Teamsters are coming to meet. And so to do that, he has to go to the Western Conference of Teamsters, headquartered here in Seattle. He has to come and ask for permission. So he drives up and he meets with Frank Brewster, who's the president of the Western Conference, and thus he's a vice president of the Teamsters Union, and asks for permission. And Frank Brewster says, all right, as long as you let my guy, this Thomas Maloney, he's a local gambler here in Seattle. He had actually a place over in Spokane, too. You help him get set up in Portland. And you give him a place in exchange for, you getting access to the labor temple. He says, all right. So they start one property here, a brothel here, a gambling joint over here, and it started to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, James Elkins was pretty good at what he did, and he knew that all he had to do was to pay off a cop, and they would have a place pinched, and he would be able to move his competition out. Well, that wasn't going to work with these guys, because these guys from Seattle are backed by the Teamsters Union. Now, the Teamsters Union is also really interested in getting a lock into Portland, because they wanted to control the distribution of alcohol and sales of alcohol in Oregon. And they trying to control that was a pretty big operation. So this sort of naturally tied in with, alcohol sales and distribution into illegal drinking spots and gambling and prostitution. It all kind of works together. So anyway, so James Elkins starts to get a little nervous about this relationship now that he has with these Seattle racketeers, also including Joseph McLaughlin, who was a mobster from Seattle that was great competition for the Colacurcio family at the time, which should ring bells too here in Seattle. So these guys, come down from Seattle, and James Elkins is starting to get a little bit nervous, but he's not only facing these racketeers from Seattle, but he's also, they're backed by the Teamsters Union. You just can't wipe these guys out. They're backed by a huge organization with, some muscle. And so what does he do? Well, he decides he's going to blackmail the guys. He's going to set them up, and he takes recording bugs and puts them all over this apartment there in Portland, King Towers. It's on King Avenue just off of Burnside. He bugs this whole apartment, and then he convinces that Thomas Maloney, this is one of our racketeers from Seattle and Spokane coming down, that's actually his occupation. He lists it as Teamster organizer, so he's on the Teamster payroll. He convinces Thomas Maloney to move into this apartment, and he records conversations between, Thomas Maloney and Joseph McLaughlin, two racketeers, and the district attorney that they're now paying off in Portland, as well as an OLCC, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, agent who's helping them set up the larger alcohol distribution, the whole monopoly there, trying to get the Teamsters, get their control of alcohol sales and distribution in Oregon. So we have these recordings, or Elkins has these recordings. And he decides that's the only thing he could do to regain control is by taking these recordings and exposing this operation. So he goes to the Oregonian. And if he could, he would have thrown the tapes right through the window of the Oregonian, but he didn't need to do that. He had a relationship already with Wally Turner, this reporter, an investigative reporter who had gone to Elkins on several occasions to get information on local crime stories, narcotics trafficking or even bootlegging or even political corruption in Portland. In the exchange, Wally Turner wouldn't mention Elkins or any of his operations in any of his stories. So they had a relationship. He was like, he was the snitch, basically. So Wally Turner got this story from Elkins that not only the Teamsters are getting involved in local organized crime, but we're paying off the district attorney, and it could even go higher than that to the mayor's office. And it's a pretty incredible story. And so, and the proof is the tapes. So he hands over these wiretap tapes. Well, Wally Turner and his partner, William Lambert, there at the Oregonian, they do their fact checking. They're not just going to take Elkins's, word. They do more investigating for about 3 months. They move out of their offices there at the Oregonian. They figure they want to go into seclusion. They're interviewing, more criminals outside of the Oregonian office, and they get this incredible story together. They're about to launch it, and they send, the editors of the Oregonian send a letter to the governor saying that, OLCC is implicated in this. Not only that, but we have local, political corruption here with the district attorney. And the governor sent a representative to hear the tapes, to look at, to talk to Turner and Lambert, the Oregonian reporters, and then the governor didn't do anything about it. So 3 days after the governor after they didn't hear anything from the governor, they launched this expose, April 1956, just blowing the lid off of this whole thing, that not only do we have organized crime here in Portland, but the Teamsters are involved, and by the way, the district attorney is also involved. And they had, our top law enforcement officers. So, and that pretty much shut it down for Elkins. Once crime and vice crime was exposed, it pretty much shut things down, all this attention on. And of course, there'll be ensuing investigations. Not only the district attorney who's implicated in this whole thing starts a grand jury investigation of his own. Of course, the governor eventually shuts that down and puts the Attorney General, Oregon State Attorney General, in charge of the investigation. But it's such an explosion that it's hard to think that folks in Washington, D.C. aren't going to get word of this. At the same time this story is exploding, senators, Congress, and federal investigators have been looking into labor racketeering. the Teamsters Union. They were looking into particularly just labor leaders and their abuse, basically, of welfare funds, of their, you know, pensions and insurance policies. And, you know, it's sort of the Jimmy Hoffa story, really, the connection, even the connection to organized crime. So here we have a Senate committee, on investigations. It's chaired by Senator John McClellan from Arkansas, and the chief counsel is Robert Kennedy. And Robert Kennedy's, everyone knows Robert Kennedy has this vendetta really against Jimmy Hoffa for who knows why, but he does. It's pretty incredible. And so Robert Kennedy's been going around state to state, city to city, trying to get all this information on labor racketeering to, you know, have, you know, to hopefully, you know, create a special subcommittee that, you know, it'll expose these guys and he could go after Jimmy Hoffa. Well, so he's in New York and, you know, he's in Chicago investigating the Teamsters. He's in Los Angeles. And actually, while he's in Los Angeles, the chief of police, he's down there talking, Robert Kennedy's talking to the chief of police. You know, the real story is up in Portland. You ought to go to Portland. Well, we thought about it, but, you know, I think our next stop is actually Seattle. So they come up to Seattle. They're kind of ignoring this story in Portland a little bit, but they're up in Seattle and they start making those connections between Frank Brewster, the vice president of the Teamsters, the president of the Western Conference. They see this connection to Portland. And so eventually Robert Kennedy comes to Portland and that's it. That's the spark. He's got a guy now, James Elkins, who's really trying to get his operations back. He's willing to talk. He's gone to the Oregonian. He's got, you know, he's clearly is willing to help, and he does. And James Elkins and Robert Kennedy actually become friends. And so all this investigating and all this evidence around the country, eventually they create the McClellan Committee, which was the Senate Committee on, you know, investigating labor racketeering. And number one, right out of the chute, day one of these hearings, it's Portland. It's Wally Turner and William Lambert talking about their investigation. They call in, you know, 22 witnesses from the Pacific Northwest, mostly from Portland. And James Elkins is actually their star witness. And he testifies more than anybody else because not only does he have that connection to organized crime, really, because he is the organized crime there in Portland, but he had that relationship with the Teamsters Union, and that's what Robert Kennedy was looking for. And eventually this committee will lead to, you know, Jimmy Hoffa he'll be arrested for trying to bribe a McClellan committee investigator, but, you know, eventually they get some dirt on Jimmy Hoffa, but actually the McClellan committee hearings actually hurt Dave Beck, the president of the, you know, International Conference of Teamsters, the president of the Teamsters living here in Seattle. Actually hurts him more than anybody else, and they find evidence that he was abusing, you know, Teamster funds, embezzlement, and he'll go to federal, you know, the federal penitentiary. So, coming back to James Elkins, he's pretty important to the story, but he's not the focus necessarily of the book. He's a really colorful figure. He's, you know, photographs in the book are incredible because just his photograph is just, he's a really interesting guy. And by the way, a sort of side note, last Thursday, it might have been Wednesday, I was online, I was working on some research, and all of a sudden in my inbox, in my email, I get an email from Jim Elkins. Whoa, that's some pretty serious spam or something going on. And it happened to be Jim Elkins Jr., sent me an email. He got a copy of the book and really, really friendly email. Says, "You probably don't know me, but my dad was James Elkins. He wrote about him in the book. And I just, you know, wanted to see if you'd sign a copy of the book." And it was really a nice email. He lives in Wyoming and really, really great. So that sort of struck me as like, whoa, this is kind of creepy because James Elkins actually was killed in the early 60s. In Arizona. He basically has to leave Portland. He's not going to have an operation anymore in Portland. Portland's wide, you know, just completely, everybody's concentrating on crime in Portland. So he moves out to Arizona and tries to, you know, create another operation down in Globe, Arizona. And there's a story told by another writer, Phil Stanford, down in Portland, where James Elkins is in a auto accident, and the official report was that he had a heart attack. And Phil Stanford interviewed a vice cop there in Portland that they thought that was kind of weird that he just had a heart attack and died. And the story goes that these guys went down and checked out the autopsy photos of Jim Elkins and found that that heart attack was probably caused by two bullet holes in his chest. So that's the story. I don't know. You know, I tell it exactly how Phil Stanford tells it down there, but James Elkins is a really colorful figure, but yeah, that's sort of the snapshot. The focus of the book is the center of the book is that vice scandal in 1956. But as a teacher, I kept thinking about, well, what questions are my students going to ask me about, you know, or ask me every day about this type of topic? And the questions like, how did we get there? And what were the consequences? Not just the story, not just James Elkins, not just the vice scandal in 1956, but so part of the book is getting us up to, you know, providing the context behind this, which I ask my students to do all the time. You know, you can't just write me a paper on Pearl Harbor. What's the context? Right? So I do that in the first part of the book, building up the context and, you know, this history of corruption and vice crime in Portland. And I think it's really, really important that we understand how we got there. And then I spend some time on the consequences of the investigation and the reason why it's important that we even study Portland. If it's not a unique story, why are we doing it? Well, because it's a unique story to Portland. But the same thing is going on in Chicago and New York. Why not? Why isn't there a book on it? Now, why aren't we studying Portland in my urban history class? Now we are.
Were the public officials that were involved with that particular case that Elkins was involved with, did they serve jail time?
The district attorney at the time that was implicated didn't serve jail time. He was eventually fined like $400 or so. And that was it. But he was obviously was no longer the district attorney. He was removed from his post there and went into private practice as a lawyer for a while. And he's a really interesting topic too. Side stories about this district attorney, William Langley, you know, incredible amateur golfer. And he has two sons that are really, really fascinating, really interesting guys that I met in Portland. They told me some really great stories about their father. You know, good stories. You know, I don't want to, you know, just focus on the corruption there. But not, you know, it didn't serve jail time. The expose and the vice scandal actually implicated the sheriff, the Multnomah County Sheriff Terry Schrunk, who actually, at the time that this whole thing blows up, has announced his candidacy for mayor. And while the campaign is going on, Robert Kennedy swoops in and they stop sort of the local investigation for this national investigation, subpoenaing everybody. And meanwhile, Terry Schrunk is elected mayor. And he goes to Washington, D.C. too to testify to the McClellan Committee. And they're asking him questions about his relationship with James Elkins and whether or not he took payoffs. There's one story in the book where I talk about how there were tons of, you know, dozens of witnesses that saw him as the sheriff picking up a package right outside a nightclub that the sheriff had just closed down temporarily, took his payoff and left, and then the nightclub was able to reopen again. 12 at least, or 13 witnesses that showed that he took this payoff, and some of them were Portland police officers. So, but he goes on, he is indicted, and there'll be trials, and he's acquitted, and there are folks in the audience, in the gallery, whatever, that are clapping. They love this guy, and he goes and serves four terms as mayor. But his closest advisor, Ray Kell, his lawyer and his campaign manager and a real prominent lawyer in Portland, said that the whole episode changed him, Terry Schrunk, politically. And he became very, very conservative, and they cleaned up, at least temporarily, cleaned up the city of Portland. And, you know, these things go in waves anyway. All this attention, of course, everything's going to either disappear, move out of town, or go underground. And then the cycle comes back up about in the 1970s or so. But Terry Shrunk, you know, survives and goes on to be a pretty popular, there's a Shrunk Plaza, you know, in Portland. And his son is a really, he's still the district attorney. Michael Shrunk is the district attorney there in Multnomah County, and a great guy, and pretty successful, very successful district attorney, very, very popular, and he's been there for a number of years. So, but that, as far as political officials, they pretty much either were fired, like the chief of police just left, or they, you know, had a small fine. That's about it.
Unfortunately, we only have a few minutes left.
Okay.
One of the many interesting things I came across in your book was you actually have segments talking about how important this group that was involved with the Vice and the Teamsters were in land acquisitions, like for Memorial Coliseum, Portland Civic Auditorium, bridges.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, there's sort of another side story about Memorial Coliseum, which is where the Portland Trailblazers used to play. Now it's a Rose Garden, of course. Memorial Coliseum's still there, I believe, yeah. These racketeers come, the two racketeers that come down are from Seattle that are, you know, basically representing the Teamsters with a local Teamster organizer, Clyde Crosby, there in Portland, with James Elkins. They create this scheme as they're building Memorial Coliseum, or they're just planning the site for this exposition recreation building, you know, that will eventually become Memorial Coliseum. Well, Clyde Crosby is a prominent Teamster organizer there in Portland, finds himself, he is able to be on the committee to decide on the site. He's appointed there by the mayor. So he's on the committee, and he basically has the inside on where the site's going to be located. So when they come down to finalizing where the Memorial Coliseum is going to be located, he then sends James Elkins. He talks to James Elkins and Thomas Maloney and Joseph McLaughlin, and they have another local guy in real estate down there, and they start buying up the land around one of the potential sites. And then Clyde Crosby clearly is able to affect which site's going to be chosen. And so they want to buy the options to have, you know, obviously this is going to be really lucrative land. Well, James Elkins was in charge of buying the options to getting the lock on that land. And when he starts getting nervous about his relationship with these guys, with the Teamsters and these racketeers from Seattle, he lets the options run out. And so through the wiretap tapes, he actually hears that they're gonna frame him and possibly kill him. And one of the biggest motivations is not that he's trying to double cross them, but that he let these options run out and they lost thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's sort of a side story in the book that's very interesting and I think still relevant, very relevant today.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time.
Oh, well.
There's not enough time to cover all this.
Well, thank you very much.
But since you're over in Spokane, you'll probably be back this way.
Absolutely. Later.
All right.
Absolutely.
And you're working on a book on Dave Beck as well.
Yeah, starting the research on Dave Beck, the president of the Teamsters in the mid-50s.
Very good. All right. Well, with that, I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
We've just been talking with Robert Donnelly. He is a assistant professor of history at Gonzaga University and author of the new book, Dark Rose, Organized Crime and Corruption in Portland.